This is the takeaway for Monday, August 21st, 2017. Hope you enjoyed that eclipse.
A solar eclipse. The cosmic ballet goes on.
My mother told me not to stare into the sun. So once when I was six, I did.
Okay, here it comes. We're going to achieve totality in 20.
Totally, yes.
19.
Totally.
18.
So happy that we're here.
I've seen it on TV, yeah. But I didn't realize it was going to be this cool in person.
There was this
total eclipse of the sun.
And now there's darkness on the face of the earth.
There it is! A total eclipse! Isn't science beautiful?
This is The Takeaway. I'm Ray Suarez, and this week, good to have you with us.
Wow, this is Don. I'm calling from Woodburn, Oregon. We just went into totality.
A thing of beauty and a scientific wonder. For those of us in the continental United States, it's been a long wait, 99 years to be exact, but Eclipse Day was finally here.
We've got a group of about 50 people in our Gordon Courtyard at the condo complex. This is just absolutely amazing. Wow. At our location, we've got about 60 seconds where we can look without the eclipse glasses. There's Corona, and I hear somebody shot off some fireworks. Well, got to enjoy. Bye-bye.
That was Takeaway listener Don calling from Woodburn, Oregon. He's one of the millions of people along the path of totality who experienced a total solar eclipse.
This is Beverly McInnes calling from Penrose, Colorado, and we are at the end of the eclipse here, and I just wanted to let you know about some of the reactions the animals had around here. We're in a rural area. The horses and the mules didn't seem to have too much concern about the eclipse. They went about their business. However, the birds, the wild birds, were very silent for a couple of minutes, and my chickens and guinea fowl were quite interesting. They all gathered up close to their coop. They didn't go in the coop like they would at night, but they all gathered up close and just laid on the ground, which is very unusual for them in the middle of the day. They just acted like they were just pulled down by gravity and stayed still for about 2 minutes. And then got up and went about their business of chasing grasshoppers again.
Takeaway listener Bev from Penrose, Colorado. The eclipse started in Oregon around 10:30 in the morning Pacific time and crossed South Carolina at 2:50 p.m. Eastern time.
Whoa!
That audio from Danielle Venton of KQED Public Radio, who's at the Lost River Field Station in Mackey, Idaho.
What we see in the eclipse is that when we look around the horizon, the first thing that happens is it's actually kind of daylight up until totality.
Jason Kendall, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University, traveled all the way to Glendoe, Wyoming, population 203, to watch the sun disappear. When we reached Jason earlier today, he was on his way to the eclipse. He explained why today is so special.
Once totality hits, you can see the corona of the sun in the sky surrounding the moon. But what happens is even more striking is stars appear. We'll be able to see some of the planets in the sky. But fascinating, wonderful thing about being out in Wyoming is that you can see along the horizon, very, very distant, where the edge of the shadow ends. And so you see kind of a glow at the edge of the horizon. So when we look overhead, we'll see it not completely, totally dark, but stars will be out. It'll be an amazing experience.
Why does it last only a couple of minutes from the beginning, where it looks like the moon's basically taking a bite out of the sun, till the sun's full out again?
Well, the moon is orbiting the Earth at approximately a kilometer a second, and at our latitude in Wyoming, the Earth is rotating at about 1,000 miles an hour, roughly speaking. But the moon takes about a couple hours to cross in front of the Earth from the perspective of the sun. So if you're looking at the eclipse from the sun, it would take a couple of hours for the moon to go across the disk of the Earth. And so the tiny shadow that we see that people try to get to in the path of totality, that races across the face of the Earth at over 1,000 miles an hour. And it takes just a few hours for that tiny shadow to go. But the partial eclipse, that takes hours because That's how long it takes for the moon to traverse in front of the Earth from the perspective of the sun.
In the last 99 years, and really, human beings have known about these events for thousands of years, what do we know now in 2017 that we didn't know the last time?
Wow. We can look at many things that we've learned over the years. One of them is in 1919, the general relativity was, of course, proved by Arthur Eddington going to off the coast of Africa and looking at the bending of starlight. That's one thing that was proved by a total solar eclipse. But the total solar eclipse this time, our science will allow us to see many more things about the nature of the corona of the sun so that we can study it better. But in terms of the science and what we know, we've got a fleet of spaceships, of orbiting space platforms that study the sun. And so those spacecraft, they actually give us more information about the sun than we would during an eclipse. So very much, this is a great, great, great pilgrimage, a human pilgrimage, more than a scientific one. The science is pretty well understood about what the moon is and what the sun is and what the eclipse is. But there are some people trying to replicate Eddington's work today, and they've been doing it. And there's other people that are trying to fly their planes in the shadow to take extended pictures to see the corona from the Earth. So in terms of the science, we know a lot today that we didn't back 100 years ago, and we don't necessarily need to rely on eclipses because coronagraphs allow that to do us every day.
Jason Kendall is an adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. He joined us earlier today from Wyoming en route to the path of totality. After the eclipse, Jason wrote us to let us know it was amazing. This is The Takeaway. I'm Ray Suarez, in for the first part of this week. Good to have you with us. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of people marched across the country to protest racism, white supremacy, and Nazism, just 1 week after a white nationalist protest turned violent in Charlottesville, Virginia. 40,000 people gathered in Boston alone to counter a self-described free speech rally that appeared to attract just a few people. President Donald Trump praised the protesters in Boston for, quote, speaking out against bigotry and hate, a far different tone from last week when the president repeatedly insisted there was blame on both sides of the violent protests. Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, reportedly pushed the president to double down on his divisive rhetoric after the protests. But the week did not end well for Bannon. On Friday, the White House confirmed he was stepping down. Just hours after that dismissal was announced, Bannon had returned to his position as executive chairman of Breitbart News, the conservative outlet that Bannon himself has called a platform for the alt-right. Eliana Johnson is a national political reporter for Politico, and she joins me now. Eliana, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Ray. Great to be with you.
Well, now that we're looking back over our shoulders at the Steve Bannon era, just how much influence did he have over candidate Trump and eventually President Trump?
I think there's a misconception that the president's head is a battlefield over which Steve Bannon, on the one hand, and more moderate advisors like Jared Kushner wage war, and on each issue, one or the other side wins. I think it's important to realize that the president does have real thoughts and instincts, and these advisors may push him one way or the other, but in the end, it's the president who makes the ultimate decision, and he does have concrete views and instincts on an array of issues. That being said, Steve Bannon was somebody who brought into the White House a deep understanding of the president's nationalist, populist base, and pushed the president to follow his own instincts, whereas many of his other advisors, I think, check those instincts and push him in a different direction.
Can Bannon himself look back at his time on the campaign and in the White House as a success? Did he accomplish what he set out to do?
I'm not sure about that. I think Bannon felt stymied in many ways by the array of, he called them, democratic, liberal, globalist advisors like Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, and Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council, who had come from Goldman Sachs. But surely he'll point to things like the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord and other things and say that they were concrete victories. At the same time, I think the failure on healthcare and the president's inability yet to do anything on tax reform are real failures. And what he has said publicly is that he feels he can be more effective from the outside back at Breitbart in pushing for victories on those matters.
We should talk some more about what it means for him to be back at Breitbart. The ink was hardly dry on the first drafts of the Bannon out story when he was already back in charge there, declaring his intention to be a player from the outside. Is that significant?
You know, I also think it's something of an overplayed story in that Bannon, when he was in the White House, was really playing an inside-outside game. I don't think he ever completely severed his ties with Breitbart, and many people saw in the stories the attack stories that Breitbart ran on, for example, Jared Kushner, Gary Cohn, and in particular attacks on H.R. McMaster, they saw Steve Bannon's hand in those stories. And I'm really of the group that doesn't think there will be all that much difference now that Steve Bannon's on the outside, though I will tell you that the major debate among White House advisors about whether or not to dismiss Steve Bannon was just how much damage can this guy do on the outside. That said, I was of the mindset that I don't think it will make all that much of a difference since I think he was playing an outside game from the inside.
Does this signal the new chief of staff having the upper hand and maybe more effectively controlling who has the president's ear?
You know, this goes back to the initial point I made about the president having a mind of his own and being the ultimate decision maker. There is a sense in which this is a victory for John Kelly, who absolutely wanted Steve Bannon out. He was somebody who reported directly to the president and in that way blurred the lines of authority in the White House. But the president himself soured on Steve Bannon and signed off on his dismissal, and Bannon wouldn't have gone had the president not signed off on this. He developed a big profile and, of course, a reputation for being the puppet master pulling the strings of the Trump presidency. And that was something that really sat wrong with Trump, who likes to take credit for all of the victories in his White House. The Time magazine cover that dubbed Bannon with his face on it, the Great Manipulator, was something that enraged the president back in the winter when it came out. And a new best-selling book by the Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Joshua Green called The Devil's Bargain, which credits Steve Bannon as being the brains behind the Trump victory in November, also really riled the president. And by the time Bannon was dismissed, the two really weren't speaking much. And as far as I know, the president hasn't spoken with Bannon since his dismissal, though he did send a kind of a cold tweet thanking him for his service. But it was John Kelly who dismissed Bannon, and the two aren't talking much, though I do think that they'll resume talking, and Bannon will be an advisor to the president from the outside at some point, over the next few weeks.
Eliana Johnson is a national political reporter for Politico. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Ray.
Rick, I just saw the bat lady upstairs, Rick. Wake up, I'm honest. I saw it for real on the fourth floor. I'm trying to tell you something. On the fourth floor. Whoa!
Help!
Ooh, oh, I'm
help!
Sorry. No, lady, don't
please.
Yell. It's a mistake. No, lady, don't yell.
Help! Someone said, how you know the government's tapping your phone? I asked in 1963. I said, anytime a Negro can owe Bell Telephone $75,000 and they don't cut the phone off, it's tapped.
Two icons of American comedy died over the weekend. Saturday, Dick Gregory, the pioneering African-American comedian and civil rights activist, died in Washington, D.C. He was 84 years old. And on Sunday, legendary comedian and filmmaker Jerry Lewis died in Las Vegas at the age of 91. Joining me in the studio is comedian Roy Wood Jr. He's a correspondent for The Daily Show and the new host of This Is Not Happening on Comedy Central. Roy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, besides an era, and I think of them both as sort of narrow lapels, white shirts, and skinny ties time, do these two men share anything?
I definitely think they share the ability to reach people with their humor. And I think that they were both clearly, if you look at their resumes, they definitely cared about the betterment of society as a whole.
What will Dick Gregory be remembered for?
Freedom fighter. I believe that that is his legacy. I believe that Mr. Gregory left a lot on the table where entertainment accolades are concerned in exchange for going to a protest or in exchange for saying something that may not have been popular with the mainstream of that time. And I would imagine, and it's probably one of the biggest regrets I have in the two times that I met him and not asking him, is what did you say no to? What things in your career did you turn down in exchange for the cause?
I spoke to him at length at the beginning of last year, and he struck me as one of those people who didn't need it.
I wonder how many black folks really realize how black folks feel about white folks and their dog. Kiss them in the mouth, take them outside, the dog run across the street, kiss another dog in the butt, come back, they don't even wash it.
It was a way to make a living.
Correct.
He was good at it. He was proud of being good at his craft, but he didn't crave it the way some comics do.
No, I always felt like that was the sugar that he put on the bitterness of the truth that he was given. And I think he found comedy to be probably one of the better delivery vehicles for that. And it was something that he was able to exploit over his time. But, you know, at the end of the day, when Dick Gregory was on stage, I don't think people expected a comedy show, so to speak. You came to laugh, but you knew you were going to leave with something more than just a couple of chuckles and a two-drink minimum. I saw him... I emceed a brunch that he did in Selma, Alabama during the Bridge Crossing Jubilee. This was 4 or 5 years ago. And Mr. Gregory just walks up to the podium very casually. And for a comedian to get laughs through, I consider a podium a joke barrier. Describe a podium. A podium presents an elegance and a regalness of what you're about to say. And as you can see here with this little microphone, and Dick Gregory was getting applause breaks, and I've never seen anything like that in my life. But it was the moments between the laughs where there was dead silence. And this is a banquet, and you didn't hear a single fork clink a plate. He had undivided attention of everyone. And I think when you think about his legacy, I don't think the first thing anyone is going to say, oh, yeah, I love that one bit he did. It's that one point he made. It's that one thing he tried to represent. I think that is his legacy.
I've never taught my children you have to be twice as smart as white people. See, children don't hear what you mean. They hear what you say. And when you tell them they got to be twice as smart, in their mind, they think they're dumb.
How about Jerry Lewis? I think the peak of his career is so long ago now that it's hard for us to remember what a huge hit he was. How profitable his movies were, how popular they were.
I think at the end of the day, where comedy is concerned, to me, that's the one good thing about comedy. I believe it to be a very timeless genre of entertainment. A laugh is a laugh. If you understand the setup, then the punchline will pay it off. And if Jerry Lewis hasn't made a movie in 20 years or 30 years, you could still sit one of his movies down in front of someone. And I guarantee you, if they have no idea who he is, no clue who he is, there's still going to be a laugh in that. And I think that's something that I feel like comedians have an ability to do. And I feel like that's why a lot of people carry comedians with them for so long, even long after you've been entertained formally by Jerry Lewis as a person of his era. If you're from Jerry Lewis's era, you remember how he made you feel. You remember how those movies touched you. You remember how those jokes made you feel. And I think that is why, you know, comedians live long, long after they're dead in our hearts.
In my experience, comics are pretty generous when talking up people who influence them. Did either man influence you?
Dick Gregory. I never had the honor of meeting Mr. Lewis, but the two times that I saw Mr. Gregory was the aforementioned at the Selma banquet, and the other time I saw him perform in Nashville, and he did about 2 hours. And he just stood up there chilling with his hot tea, and he had a couple of notes, and he had, you know, some magazines and articles and stuff that he's pulled from newspapers and libraries to, you know, to reiterate some of the points comedically. And the thing that I've always tried to say about Dick Gregory, there's certain comedians that you see as a comic who make you throw out your act, where you see a comedian and you go, man, I need to be a better comedian. And you would see Dick Gregory and you would leave the show thinking, I need to be a better person. And whatever he was talking about would eclipse your career. You weren't even thinking about, like, I've never watched Dick Gregory and thought once, man, I wish I'd have wrote that joke. It's, wow, I don't care enough. I don't think enough. I don't read between the lines on what's happening in society and to black people. And it definitely forces you to raise the bar creatively, or at least it forced me to put me in a mindset where, you know, I try my best to talk about stuff within my act that has some semblance of meaning, something that has some level of ability to reach black people or dissect a black issue. And I'm nowhere near what Dick Gregory was doing, but it at least got my compass pointed in the right direction.
Roy Wood Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Show and the new host of This Is Not Happening on Comedy Central. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Ray Suarez, in for the start of this week. It's estimated that here in the U.S., 1 in 8 young people between 16 and 24 are both unemployed and not in school. This group of Americans, often referred to as disconnected or opportunity youth, present a big challenge for organizers looking to close the inequality gap in this country. If left disengaged, these young people could grow up facing a variety of institutional problems as adults, from an overcrowded criminal justice system to a reliance on inadequate social services. But one organization is making strides to bring these kids back into the fold. John Valverde is the CEO of Youth Build USA, and he says treating young people as individuals is the key to connecting with them.
Youth Build has been around for over 38 years, and we serve 16 to 24-year-olds who are out of school and out of work, with a comprehensive positive youth development model that includes education, vocational training, community service, leadership development, and counseling and healing.
All during those 38 years that Youth Build has been around, we've been hammering away at young people, telling them that they shouldn't be out of school at 16, 17, 18, 19. How many people are we talking about?
Well, in the U.S. alone, it's over 5 million, with over 3 million of them living in poverty. And internationally, globally, we're talking about 350 million more.
It's a tough population, isn't it, though? Because these are people mainly who are low-skilled or no-skilled, not heavily workplace-affiliated, and very lightly educated.
It is challenging. There's no doubt about it. I think it's also important to recognize the trauma and the need for healing that our young people have to deal with and that we exist to support them with.
Do these young people find you? Do you find them? Are they referred to you as part of diversion programs? How do you get hooked up?
Well, it's certainly all of the above, and word of mouth is also probably our strongest driver of recruitment and enrollment. The challenge, of course, is that for every one person that we can accept into one of our Youth Build programs, we're turning away 4 or 5.
What's the best desired outcome? Are you looking to set them back on a path toward more training or more school, or basically taking them as you find them and trying to do the best you can with them where they're at?
We need our young people not just to graduate with a GED or high school equivalency or diploma. Our commitment is to generate a force of ethical young leaders who are educated, skilled, committed to service, to transform their own lives, their communities, and eventually the world. And until we do that effectively, I'm concerned that we won't be able to address this crisis.
I've known your founder, Dorothy Stoneman, for years, and she's just a straight-up hero. But she comes to the work from a very different path from the one that your life took. You're an ex-offender.
You've been incarcerated. Was this a kind of university, being on the inside, seeing the effects of that alienation, of that trauma, of that hurt?
Certainly, as a young person raised by a single mom, struggling to make ends meet, I know the challenges that our young people face. And during my period of incarceration, which was 16 years long, I certainly witnessed and experienced the broken lives that many of our communities sadly produce. And so it was through my experience in prison, where I had access to education, vocational training, opportunities to provide service to others, it wasn't until I experienced those that I found myself really envisioning a future, a different future that I could live into. Youth Build is a second chance program, and I'm so grateful to be living out my second chance at Youth Build. I mean, every day I look into the eyes of our young people, and I see the potential in them. We need to look beyond what people have done, or their past, their upbringing, the mistakes they may have made, to who they are today and who they can be in the future. If we focus just on the return on investment, the cost of one person going through a Youth Build program compared to the criminal justice system, for example, or a reliance on public assistance as a different example, the return on investment is clear.
Youth Build serves in all different kinds of communities. In an urban setting, there's a lot of work that can be done by young people. When I think of some of the rural communities I've visited, where even the adults can't find work, that must be a much tougher road for you guys.
Nowadays, the rural challenges are being lifted up and compared with urban challenges. And we're seeing over the years, our rural work has grown now to 25% of our programs are in rural communities. The same healing and unresolved trauma issues that I named earlier, plus the educational challenges, vocational challenges, employment challenges, yes, they are, in fact, very similar. Transportation remains a major barrier. Broadband is another major barrier. The lack of employment that you mentioned, poor educational outcomes. The dynamics are different, but from our young person's perspective, it's very much the same.
Youth Build has a proven track record, many examples of success. Are you sometimes surprised how hard a sell it is to governments, to private philanthropy?
Well, first, I have to say how grateful we are to have such bipartisan support. There are so many social challenges in the world that need our attention and need philanthropy's attention and focus. I know that the way forward is stronger collaboration with other stakeholders and other community members that understand that we just simply cannot lose another generation to this crisis.
John Valverde is the CEO of Youth Build USA. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Ray. I appreciate it.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill last Tuesday that bans the state's insurers from covering abortions in general plans. The new law means even in cases of rape, incest, or where the fetus is not viable, a woman would have to buy a supplemental plan in order to have the procedure covered. Abortions for medical emergencies will still be covered. State Representative Donna Howard is a Democratic lawmaker representing Texas's 48th District. She opposed the bill in the House. Representative Howard joins me now. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Texas's leaders have been trying to find ways to make it harder to have an abortion in the state of Texas. Is this just another step down that road?
Well, I would suggest that it is. We're talking here about preventing insurance from covering abortions. Quite frankly, right now, the major carriers in Texas, just like everywhere else, primarily cover abortions that are medically necessary. That means that they actually cover abortions for rape and incest, as well as for the health of the mother. Right now, this legislation that was proposed and passed will prevent that kind of coverage, even for fetal abnormalities, pushing costs off onto the consumer, especially in the light of what the cost of a late-term abortion, if you have a fetal abnormality, a non-viable fetus. This legislation will force you to carry that fetus to term rather than being able to have the abortion at a time when you can actually medically and mentally deal with this and have that covered by insurance. This is outrageous, actually, that women are being asked to consider purchasing supplemental insurance when they get pregnant in the event that they may happen to have a fetal abnormality.
Are we talking about all women? Are there insured women in Texas who won't see any change in their coverage?
Well, actually, right now, the we do cover primarily for rape and incest. That will no longer be the case. So, I mean, what mother, myself included, would I think to purchase supplemental abortion insurance to cover the potential rape of my child so that my child could then have an abortion after being raped? This is outrageous. This is ridiculous. What they're asking us to do is to offer supplemental coverage for something that is already not covered by insurance. It really actually makes no sense whatsoever.
Does this run afoul of the plain language of Roe v. Wade that stops states from making abortion illegal?
There seems to be a continuous effort here in Texas to create more and more obstruction to access to this legal medical procedure. And I understand that some of my colleagues would just like to see abortion go away. And they think that if they create all of these barriers and obstacles, that that will eventually lead to the fact that we will no longer have abortion. Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. Prior to Roe v. Wade, women sought abortion. We had thousands of maternal deaths each year as a result of these abortions that were done illegally. And since we've had Roe v. Wade, that has precipitously dropped. We know that if indeed we get to the point where we make it harder and harder, we will see an increase in those abortions that are done unsafely, and that we will see more women die. And quite frankly, here in Texas, we have the highest maternal morbidity rate associated with pregnancy. That's what we should be focusing on. We should be focusing on how do we prevent these unplanned pregnancies in the first place by introducing contraception.
Donna Howard is a member of the Texas State Legislature. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. And now another approach to criminal justice reform operating outside the boundaries of state courts. There are more than 300 tribal courts across the country, operating in tandem with the U.S. judicial system, and these courts often use the tribe's traditions and beliefs to approach criminal justice. Tribal Justice, a new documentary premiering tonight on PBS's documentary series POV, follows the chief judges for the two largest tribes in California.
The state has a lot of responsibility for all the people. I have responsibility just for this one set of people.
I know she does.
6,000 Yurok's and their families. And that's what I'm responsible for, and to this land, to this place. It's everything, really. I mean, this place is everything. It's what it's all about for us. I mean, I don't even know how to say it.
Abby Abenanti is the chief judge of the Yurok tribe in the far northern coast of California.
6,000 Yuroks and their families. And that's what I'm responsible for, and to this land, to this place.
And Judge Claudette White is from the Quetzal tribe in the deserts of Southern California, just north of the Mexican border.
Every time I come back home, it's just a feeling. I see the tumbleweeds on the side and the cottonwood trees and the tamaracks and salt cedars in the fields, and I know I'm home.
Both judges use restorative justice in their courtrooms, preferring to work out deals with rehab and work placement instead of incarceration for the people who break the law on their land. I spoke with Judge Claudette White about her work on the Quetzal Reservation, as well as the producer and director of the film, Anne Makepeace.
I think the film is a real eye-opener, and their courts can serve as a model
of restorative justice, which is a movement going on now across the country in state courts. And many state courts that are interested in restorative justice techniques are looking to tribal courts and the methods used there because they're more humane. They're not about punishment. They're about restoration. So I think it's plugging in at a really opportune time to open people's eyes and reveal a new kind of justice that actually works and does not result in mass incarceration.
Judge White, you're one of the judges around whom this story is built. In the exercise of sovereignty, do you sometimes attract the attention, unwelcome, unwanted, negative, of nearby communities that are off the reservation, away from tribal lands? Because you're presiding over some fairly serious crimes.
Yes, I would say that we do. In some instances, I think that's primarily based on lack of understanding and education. And hopefully this film will give some insight into what's happening in tribal courts and people in the broader public, as opposed to just the tribal communities and those working within our community and structures, will learn more about why tribes have the sovereignty and autonomy to have their own courts and exercise in their own jurisdictions. And when we deal with criticism or we deal with negative images or views about what's occurring, I've often taken the time to help educate and to try to share information with others so they can learn and appreciate what it is we're doing in our courts.
In one case in particular, a repeat offender, meth addict, is arrested after getting into a single car accident on somebody's front lawn. He's driving around high on crystal meth. This is not his first offense. And as I watched the process roll out, I thought about how that person would be treated in a county court in Arizona, in California, in Nevada.
Well, I'm in rehab. I'm doing really good. I'm secretary of the rehab right now. I should be moving up to president of the rehab. And this is really the first time in my life I've ever been off drugs, really. I was in, like, locked up a long time. I was in prison most of my life. This is really the first chance where it opened my eyes and got me to look at myself and not just others.
So I'd say at this point you're in full compliance, and we will communicate that to the state court also. What a good job you're doing, and we will help you in those hearings. And we want to support you through that process too.
Right. They would take a more punitive approach with regards to dealing with an individual who is a repeat offender. One of the concepts we use in tribal courts, and it's really one of the core concepts and values, is these people who are offending are going to return to our community most likely and live amongst us, and we want to have and achieve success, not just for themselves, but for the entire tribal community. And so if we give another person an opportunity and another chance to try to get things right, to offer rehab services or whatever it is they need to help them be successful and to live, you know, independent and free of drug abuse, then we're willing to provide those opportunities, because incarcerating them repeatedly isn't achieving success. And we see that occurring nationwide with mass incarceration. And I think we see more success than failure.
Judge White, the rampant use of alcohol and drugs is not something that you and your family have been able to escape.
No, I don't think we've been able to escape any of the dysfunction or tragedies that affect a number of families in any community, and in particular my own community, and I share some of that in the film.
My dad, we actually lost him to a drug overdose of cocaine and heroin. But it put a real fear in me.
I think that really helps give me a good understanding and appreciation, and allows me to exercise empathy when I am dealing with individuals going through those circumstances.
How do you explain it to yourself that this remains such a persistent problem?
I don't know that I can explain it to myself completely and make sense of it. It's just something that we deal with as a reality. It's around us. There is a lot of disadvantages sometimes to living on reservation, especially in the communities and areas we're in, geographically located. Both of the counties around us are high unemployment areas. And there are a lot of situations where people feel hopeless and turn to those things. And we look into our past,
with regards to things like historical trauma and the fact that we're just building as nations still in grasping concepts of how maybe outside of the tribal community might determine and define success in trying to achieve those things and learning to embrace those as well.
And make peace for you. You're talking to an audience that's going to be, in many cases, learning from scratch this fascinating story. What do you want them to take away from this?
Well, I guess there are many things. I'd like them to think about that there are many very functional people on reservations. You know, they're not all down and out. There are people who are really working to make life better and who are leading successful lives. And these women are models of that. And then the other thing I alluded to earlier is I would like people to think about our criminal justice system and realize, you know, there maybe there's a different way to think about justice, to think about it as resolving issues and healing rather than incarceration and warehousing people that leads to nothing good.
And Make Peace is the producer and director of Tribal Justice. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Claudette White is the chief judge of the Kwetsun Tribal Court. Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Tribal Justice premieres tonight on the PBS documentary series POV. We still want to hear your stories from the eclipse.
My name is Darlene, and I live in Bend, Oregon, which is very close to the totality. I am going to prepare my glow sticks, step outside, put on my glasses, and maybe look up toward the eclipse.
Keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Ray Suarez. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.